Today on the Monocle Weekly, edition 91, we're in Tokyo for a special edition of the program with our editors and correspondents in Japan and London.
There's a real sense in Japan between all those groups in politics, business, the public, of pulling together. And so I think in some ways, Mr. Khan, if he remains Prime Minister, has been handed an extremely big chance.
That was Gwen Robinson of the Financial Times. And we'll also be talking to our Fiona Wilson about how the story has played out in the Japanese media.
For those of you that just tuned in to NHK World, you're seeing live coverage from our helicopters of a tsunami engulfing...
The best coverage was, of course, coming from the Japanese news agencies and newspapers who could put helicopters out, because what we needed to see, first of all, the images. And it took a couple of days to actually report these human stories about how bad it really was for people on the ground.
And now, from Tokyo, the Monocle Weekly.
Hello and welcome to the special edition of the Monocle Weekly from the studios of Tokyo Broadcasting. I'm Tyler Brulé, along with Gwen Robinson of the Financial Times. With me here in studio, our Tokyo bureau chief, Fiona Wilson, who's down the line from Kyoto, and our editor, Andrew Tuck, in our London studio. Before we get to all of them, though, we start the program with a review of the events of the last 9 days. Here's our Jonathan Openshaw.
At 2:46 p.m. on Friday the 11th of March, an earthquake measuring 8.9 on the Richter scale struck 78 miles off Japan's east coast. Within minutes, a wall of water 10 meters high was racing towards the shore. The world watched it coming. The astonishing pictures from the Coast Guard's helicopters beamed back to NHK and around the globe. In the first few hours, the scale of the disaster was unclear. News channels reported 3 dead, then dozens, hundreds unaccounted for, then thousands. But as we watched the waves effortlessly roll through everything in their path, there could be no mistaking the magnitude of the disaster. On that first day, the nuclear power station at Fukushima was hardly mentioned. The Tokyo Electric Power Company, TEPCO, said the plant had shut down automatically. The chief cabinet secretary reassured people there was no radiation leak. The focus instead was on the humanitarian disaster, the stories of ships missing, entire trains swept away, the towns and villages cut off from the world. The next day, as the official death toll rose, the nuclear questions became more urgent. There was an explosion at the plant, the exclusion zone was widened, the first panic discussions took place in Tokyo about which way the wind might blow. By Sunday, Prime Minister Naoto Kan was calling this Japan's biggest crisis since the Second World War. No one could accuse him of exaggerating. On top of the humanitarian and environmental disaster came the threat of a financial one. The Nikkei dropped dramatically, and the Bank of Japan injected 15 trillion yen, about 150 billion euros, into the money markets. By the start of this week, the political fallout had spread across the world. The issue of nuclear power, long dormant in so many Western countries since the battles over its safety a generation ago, was revived. EU countries ordered immediate safety tests at the 153 nuclear power reactors across the continent. China suspended its nuclear building programme. Japan is one of the most technologically advanced countries in the world, arguably the most. And yet here was the Japanese military, reduced to dumping seawater from helicopters in a desperate attempt to cool the spent fuel rods. Most of the water simply dispersed in the wind. As the week went on, we all became experts in nuclear terminology, and the rescue and recovery efforts continued. There were stories of hope, the old man found drifting out to sea on the roof of what remained of his house, and there were stories of incredible bravery, the Fukushima 50, a small group of workers, emergency personnel and scientists who stayed behind to save the nuclear plant and their fellow citizens. By yesterday, as the first reports emerged that radiation had found its way into the food chain, there was one ray of hope. Engineers had managed to connect an emergency power cable to Fukushima, allowing the possibility that the water pumps could be restarted and the fuel rods cooled. But as the crisis entered its 10th day, the police agency reported that 7,197 people have died and 10,905 are still missing. A reminder of the human toll Japan has already suffered.
That report by Jonathan Openshaw. Gwen, I thought I would start with you. I'm not sure whether you were at the FT Bureau or where you were on the Friday when the story broke, but how did it hit your screens or wherever you happened to be?
Well, I happened to be working from home and I'm on the ground floor, and I guess anybody who lives and works in Tokyo every day, it's never really far from your mind that this could be the big one. So when the tremors started. I happened to be working and writing a story, and as usual, one kind of grabs the table and looks around nervously. But when it developed and after a while became an incredibly violent shaking, and then suddenly things were falling, shelves, vases, things were tipping off the walls, and I realised it was an extremely serious quake. Funnily enough, the internet never went off, and so I guess one gets dazed. After a while, when the shaking stopped, I just continued doing my article thinking, gee, that was bad. Maybe there's some damage. And I surfed the net and tried to find out. All the phone networks went down. And this has been the huge problem also immediately in the aftermath that we couldn't use mobiles or landlines. But clearly the television, NHK, got onto it fairly quickly, the national broadcaster, and it became very apparent very quickly how serious it was.
Fiona, we were chatting on the line that Friday afternoon, and it was quite clear to you that this was certainly a quake unlike any other that that you felt almost, you know, after a decade in Japan.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. My experience is very similar to Gwen's, because I was in the office, I was working away, and I'm also used to tremors. And, you know, as Gwen said, you're always expecting something even bigger. And but I think we realised very quickly, it just was the reaction of everybody on the street as well. I looked out the window, well, I was just kind of hanging on to the window, actually, as it was rattling, watching the enormous trees on Omotesando creaking. And it just, everybody stopped absolutely in their tracks, and the traffic. And that never happens on Omotesando, if it's a street, you know. So we realised that something big was up. But as Gwen said, phone lines went down immediately. And it was difficult at first to know what was going on. You thought somewhere there must be damage. It was apparent it wasn't in front of us. So we weren't really sure, and I think that's been the extraordinary thing about this event. It's unfolded hour by hour.
From a media point of view, what was the source that you went to immediately, or were you receiving calls from elsewhere when you're slightly ahead of the story? But, you know, where did you turn?
I mean, I think the Japanese media was the first port of call. I usually go to NHK, the state broadcaster, and that's actually, I've been looking at that probably more than anything, partly because NHK World has been broadcasting an English language soundtrack at the same time, so it's been very helpful for foreign residents. I don't know if they all know that.
Andrew, for you in London, was it apparent quite early on again that this was a story unlike any other?
I think on the Friday, the extraordinary thing was that people knew that quite quickly that there'd been immense damage, and obviously we saw the tidal wave. And again, thanks to NHK, the coverage covered by most European international media stations came directly from NHK. And for us, what's interesting, obviously in our office we have a lot of Japanese staff. So we gathered around the TV in the afternoon and we kind of watched as the events unfolded. And even then, there's that terrible gap in reality when there's an announcement from the official saying it's believed that up to 19 people are dead. And you could see the destruction and this very low figure, and you just knew that couldn't be correct. But I think even for some of the Japanese staff in the office, who they quickly contacted family back in Japan to make sure that they were okay, and obviously we contacted Fiona in the office, but there was this strange gap between the reality of the images you were seeing and these very low figures that were coming out. And I think even for some of our Japanese staff, I was speaking to Yoshi yesterday, and he was saying, it's terrible. On Friday, I didn't really take it that seriously. I knew it was bad, but it wasn't until the next day or that evening, really, in London time, that as it began to unfold, that he realised the enormity of what had happened.
Well, Andrew, I mean, you mentioned the enormity, and Gwen, I was going to ask you, and Fiona, I'll come to you next, but I have to say I was quite surprised at how quickly, let's say, the major international broadcasters, you know, were able to put a lot of people on the ground here, because, you know, and we've spoken about this before, you know, we've seen huge cutbacks, bureau closures, you know, in Japan, because the story, in the broad sense, or certainly from a regional news gathering point of view, has moved elsewhere. And, you know, I'm wondering if there's also a sense that, you know, some of them are a little bit on the back foot.
That's a very good point, Tyler. We've got the FT, for example, has just 5 reporters now in the bureau. And I think we've, not to pat ourselves on the back too much, but with that small handful, it's been pretty amazing. Two went up right away trying to get to the affected area. And I know a lot of the other media organisations, the big ones, have brought in reinforcements from overseas. We've had help from regional bureaus everywhere, reporters feeding in. 2 of our reporters who are in the region have stayed up there for now basically since Saturday. They haven't come back. They've been trying to get around dealing with things. And then, of course, as you said, there has been this influx of foreign reporters from overseas, who many who've never been to Japan, which has flavoured the coverage somewhat to
well,
see
it,
people
it has,
who've never been to Japan sort of trotting around in these devastated areas.
I want to come back to that point as well, because I think that this is, on so many levels, has been, you know, a story unlike any other. But Fiona, your experience as well, you know, certainly you have a lot of friends who are in the international, but also domestic media community here. Just your views about how the foreign coverage and at least the speed of response has played out.
Well, I mean, very quickly, a lot of people were coming in, particularly from Beijing, because that's where a lot of correspondents from Japan ended up moving to when bureaus closed here. And, of course, they were trying very hard to get back in. It was frustrating for them. They were all desperately looking for fixes and transport to the north, which was very difficult. In fact, I don't think, you know, the authorities particularly wanted a lot of people clogging up the roads. So I had a lot of calls from people who were looking for practical help. They wanted translators, fixes. And I think that's why initially the best coverage was, of course, coming from the Japanese news agencies and newspapers who could put helicopters out, because what we needed to see first of all the images. And it took a couple of days to get people on the ground to actually report these human stories about how bad it really was for people on the ground.
I mean, Andrew, you were remarking on this on the day, just, you know, whether it was sort of Friday or Saturday when we were talking, that from a coverage point of view, this was just so different because of the sophistication of the market from a media point of view, that, you know, all television broadcasters have multiple helicopters, but also because of the sophistication of the warning system, it was very clear that there was going to be a sizable tsunami. So those images that we saw, those choppers were already in the air.
Well, you know, the world has witnessed or has seen many tsunamis before and earthquakes, but never has footage like this come out. I think there were a couple of things that worked, and it's terrible to say, in its favour for the coverage, but it happened during daylight. It happened at a time, you know, in the middle of the day when there were lots of people around who were at work, ready to start reporting. They got the choppers up really quickly. The footage that has slowly come out from cameramen and from photographers, I think it's for the first time you really understand the terror of what you would feel like if you saw that wall of water coming to you, and the impossibility of escaping. When you watch a clip that's 2 or 3 minutes long that starts with a trickle of water coming up a street and ends with a whole town being washed away, suddenly you realise why the numbers that, you know, we're going to eventually see for the people who have lost their lives are going to be extraordinary. I think that it's a remarkable piece of media coverage. It's been extraordinary.
I think also another point is that because we've seen the previous big disasters, such as in Haiti or the Southeast Asian tsunami, we had a different level of development in these areas. But here, everybody has mobile phones. It's an incredibly wired society in Japan, even up north in, you know, slightly more rural areas. So what we're seeing now, even the weekend following the first weekend after it, new footage coming out almost every day from people's cameras, videos, mobile phones. And some of that is even more staggering than the early footage.
I mean, Gwen, from the point of view of the FT and just the evolution of the story, you know, over the course of, you know, of a week, obviously there are the main points that you have to cover. And it was, you know, certainly come Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday, you know, the impact, you know, on the markets. Mm. Where have been the other areas of focus for you? I mean, of course, aside from the obvious, the radiation story, of course, you know, aside from just, you know, the ongoing rescue and recovery effort.
Right. That's a good point. Particularly being the FT with our duty to sort of cover the economy and markets as well, there's a big element of that. But as you say, I think the number one thing has been that keeping an eye on the nuclear situation, which is become more and more serious. Worldwide, we've had to look at the future of nuclear policy and really assess a much broader angle of energy policy in general. But I think the big story, apart from the human tragedy and keeping up on all that, is the enormous effect on supply chains that the devastation in this region and how it's knocked out factories could cause on all sorts of companies, particularly things like the IT, tech, car makers. So there's that aspect as well.
The logistics component is extraordinary. And, you know, Fiona, sometimes I almost feel like you become our Konbini correspondent. But you, I mean, maybe interesting just to sort of, you know, highlight, we've been hearing about, of course, all of the shortages, et cetera. And it wasn't until I arrived in the country midweek and people were talking about the empty shelves, et cetera. It's not a case that it's because the vans weren't working or anything else. I think people sort of forget the fact that shops like 7-Eleven and Lawson are restocking themselves, you know, three or four times a day. So, you know, as soon as there's just one glitch in the system, I mean, the whole thing really, you know, well and truly falls apart. There is no stock room.
I mean, that was very evident in supermarkets and convenience stores in central Tokyo. I think that disruption of the supply chain combined with, I wouldn't say panic buying because people haven't been, you know, openly panicking, but I mean, the supermarkets were packed. And, you know, I idly went off on Saturday morning thinking I needed some milk and bread. Well, absolutely not. You know, I couldn't get my hands on any. And I felt that panic. It was funny. It was a sort of psychological impact of that in Tokyo, I felt, as much as anything. You know, watching people with their trolleys piled high with pot noodles, it wasn't very reassuring.
Gwen, Fiona, and Andrew, we're going to come back to this discussion in a moment. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're in Tokyo. We're back after this. Back with Monocle Weekly here in Tokyo, where I'm with Gwen Robinson, Fiona Wilson, and also Andrew Tuck is in London. Gwen, just before we went, Fiona just touched on the point of just the psychological impact. And, you know, have you seen this unfold Friday, Saturday, you know, Sunday? I was in Korea by that point, and there was a number of us, you know, we were due to get on the plane, and at one point there was a piece of business which got cancelled, so one colleague didn't have to come, and I could really sense amongst the people I was traveling with there was a fear, of course, of, you know, whether it was going to be another quake or it was just a fear of radiation. And, you know, certainly from our own company point of view, we said, listen, you know, if you don't feel safe being in Japan, then you don't have to come. And it was quite funny because one dropped off in the morning, and I got as far with another colleague. He was already in the lounge with me, bags were checked, and we had to offload his luggage. So then I arrived here. But it's interesting because there's, you know, you see, you know, certainly, you know, people are trying to get on, and we, you know, I've bumped into, you know, too many business people I know who are of course, you know, they're sitting it out. But then there, you know, there has been, you know, a number of companies who've moved elsewhere. I'm wondering what the mood is, because and is there a little bit of you'd never see a backlash in corporate Japan, would you? But I do get the sense that maybe some senior Japanese managers are wondering, well, what about us?
Yes, I think it's probably a most trying situation for chief executives and people running companies that combine both foreign and Japanese staff, because I think, was it you, Andrew, who touched on the fact that, you know, a lot of Japanese have nowhere to run to. I mean, they can go west but their families are here, whereas you've got a lot of expatriates in companies who just want to get out with their families to outside of Japan. But what we've seen, which I've been covering the last few days, is coming back again to Andrew's earlier point about how people didn't at first realise how serious this is. So I talked to a lot of companies at the first weekend and then on the Monday, and some companies were moving to implement certain kind of contingency plans, but a lot of them hadn't really acted. By Tuesday, when we'd had reports of fresh fires breaking out at the nuclear plants and mounting fears of an explosion and radioactive contamination, that's when companies really began moving. And I think one of the big points was the French embassy urging its nationals to leave Tokyo. That really was a reality check for a lot of the expatriate community. Also, the expatriate community, I think, has been unnerved by the sort of more, let's say, sensationalist approach, I think, of the foreign media, which has really played on the fears of both earthquakes and nuclear contamination, but, you know, possibly quite rightly. Whereas the Japanese media and NHK, even though we do look at it as the sort of broadcaster of record, has really taken a very strong sort of position of keeping people calm, and carrying on. And that's why we've seen Japanese going about their business and trying to, you know, be, well, the overused word, stoic.
Yes.
Which they are. They're incredibly stoic. Everyone sort of behaves. Everyone's so orderly. And a lot of that, I think, comes from the media coverage. But finally, companies, I think even Japanese companies, are very nervous now. So we've had reports of many of them relocating staff to centres further west, Osaka, Kyoto, and Fiona, maybe you could tell us a bit more about the scene in Kyoto and Fukuoka in Kyushu. The favourite ones, I think, are Kyushu, Fukuoka, and Osaka in Honshu, where there are international airports. So there's a thought even at the back of people's minds that maybe going west in Japan is not even enough. Maybe you want to be near an airport where you could actually leave the country more easily.
Well, I mean, Fiona, earlier in the week, you went with your daughter down to Kyoto. You wrote a monocolumn for us about just the scene on the Shinkansen leaving the city.
Yes, it was interesting. I mean, I was expecting it to be busy. What I wasn't expecting was just how many Japanese families were piling onto the train. And when we got off at Kyoto, there were a lot of relatives waiting for people on the platform, and they looked so pleased to see their relatives. And I've heard a lot of people are trying to move west. And I think Gwen is absolutely right. It's funny. It's great to be in Kyoto, but there's certainly already become a feeling of maybe we should be further west, and maybe we should actually be nearer to Kansai Airport or Fukuoka Airport. I think that's absolutely true. I mean, there was no sense of panic on the train. It was just packed, and it was a very different crowd to the usual business people who populate the rush hour trains, usually travelling between the west and Tokyo. But I have to say, we were happy to arrive. And I think for a lot of people, the events on Tuesday really swung it, exactly as Gwen says. I think the Prime Minister's words were not very reassuring. I think people said, are they telling the truth? And I was thinking, well, how much worse do you want it to be? I mean, they basically said the power stations are, we're not really sure what's happening, and that we can't really control it. So I don't know how more truthful they could have been.
Andrew, watching the various networks that are on, you know, in the office, you know, we spend a lot of time, you know, flipping between all of them. We haven't been very glowing about NHK World sometimes, but yet it has been interesting to watch CNN versus the BBC. That's what I've been looking at since I've been in Asia. I'm not sure though how it's been playing out, let's say, when you watch the domestic feed in the UK, or certainly, you know, what Sky News has, you know, has been like with it as well. But what's been your channel of choice? And before we went on air, you made also an interesting point that I'd love you to come back to, which was just how surprised journalists are when they come here, because it's rather different sort of landing at Narita, where everything sort of, you know, does continue to, you know, to hum as best as it can.
I think the strange thing was, on those first couple of days after the quake, the people that they managed to fly in, as you say, came in from Beijing or if they came in from Korea, and lots of them weren't former correspondents from Japan at all. Lots of them didn't speak any Japanese. And so there was this awful reporting on the first days. I was listening to the radio, Radio 4, and there was a reporter and a truck went past in the background, a policeman saying something in Japanese. And the correspondent was saying, I don't know what he's saying. I'm guessing that maybe he's kind of saying, get out of the way, or maybe he's saying... And, you know, we thought, although this is the worst kind, this isn't, you know, national radio. We have people there who don't speak Japanese, who don't have a fixer, who just literally don't know what's going on around them.
Well, they couldn't even pronounce the Prime Minister's name.
No.
That was, you know, it went from like Noto to NATO to, you know, every other version, but Natokan.
Well, I'm sorry, there's been some really appalling pronunciation in the last 9 days. There really has.
I was just going to just want to say one other thing, which is the channel that's annoyed me most they have this annoying package is Sky News. Which they've made this kind of sensationalist kind of horror movie music that they run over these five clips that they keep on showing in between segments. And they go, dun, 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 dun. That's the only way that they can present it to the audience, as though it's a horror film. And it's just so inappropriate the way it's being packaged. And that's why you get this sense in the UK media, especially of real kind of just the wrong sense of it being panicked, unless you get one or two reporters, even like seasoned people like Jon Snow, who's done amazing reporting for Channel 4. But even when he talks about it, you know, he's caught up with, oh, I'm amazed, you know, there's no looting, that people are really still polite. You know, that I think people are shocked by the Japanese manner.
Fiona, perhaps it's not surprising because, frequently we talk about just how the center of gravity from a media point of view, has definitely, moved west, across the Sea of Japan. It's in Korea. It's in China. I don't want to say that this is clearly not good for brand Japan on any measure. But from a media point of view, I mean, this has to be the biggest mobilization of international media back to Japan, certainly a country and a story that's drifted, that there might be some positives to this as well, simply because, you know, foreign news editors, you know, have not been focusing on this country.
No, I think that's right. I think there was such a shift, particularly to China. I mean, I'm not sure that, you know, once this crisis passes, I'm not sure it means that correspondents will be moving back to Japan, to be honest. But I think this is an ongoing story. Obviously, and Gwen knows a lot more about this, but there's going to be, you know, what will the long-term economic impact be? The business story will certainly go on. The rebuilding will go on. But as we know, you know, it's just the nature of the media cycle that something else comes along eventually. And so just as this knocks Egypt, which knocked, you know, Libya, we knock these things off and then we move on to the next story. I mean, it'd be interesting to see once immediate crisis, which is still obviously absolutely critical, and we're still in the midst of it, once that passes, what the long-term impact for the media will be. And I think also people have found it's just not as easy to drop in here as it would be, say, in Indonesia or somewhere in, you know, somewhere Southeast Asia. You can't just drop in here, find a driver, fixer. It's much more ordered than that. And that's been quite interesting. If you don't already have the office here and a setup, it's actually quite difficult to work here.
And by that you mean, Fiona, just that, you know, it's not a case of being able to wave $200 in someone's face and commandeer a car to take you up to Sendai.
That's exactly what I mean. And I'm thinking of the call I received, you know, at about 11 o'clock on Friday night from someone
asking if you had a license.
I did say, I suggest you go and see if you can rent a car. I mean, do you have an international license? Really, you know, it's not a situation here where there are drivers desperate to do that kind of work, and certainly not in the middle of the night. So I think that was a bit of a shock for some correspondents who weren't used to working in Japan.
Is that sort of chime with I would imagine that there was probably sort of similar, you know, calls as well from other international news organizations, other newspapers who were probably looking for support as well. And, you know, I guess that's the luxury probably that you're in with having five correspondents here as well. You have a well-oiled machine. You are committed to the market.
Right.
I would imagine a lot of people have been playing catch up. I mean, I have to say, you know, even, you know, midweek, Andrew, I think you would like this. I saw a crew from Rye, from Italy. I think they were just arriving, you know, only on Wednesday.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Fiona, about that whole sort of quick in and out kind of crisis-focused story and what it will become. I mean, I think there's going to be some huge stories in Japan as a result of this. There's going to be a lot of issues, but it will be largely an economic story and some broader, very fundamental, important things, but they're not the sexy things that are going to prompt CNN to want to send, you know, sort of 10 people in to cover. It's going to be things like, for example, I think one of the other biggest things, apart from disruption to supply chains worldwide, is going to be the meltdown of these nuclear plants, which means that this vast country has lost possibly 30% of its power. And you can't just throw up a new power plant overnight. I mean, we're already suffering. I mean, TEPCO has been forced to implement all these rolling power cuts. Can you imagine the implications for everything from the sushi industry, all these poor little restaurants trying to keep their priceless tuna cold, to hospitals, to all kinds of things? But this is going to go on for very much for months, if not years. And I think it'll probably force Japan to turn back to coal for the short term and possibly develop other alternative energy sources. But, you know, they're very big stories and they're not just market-focused ones. So
I wanted to pick up on that. I'm going to throw this, you know, open to all of you. And maybe, Andrew, I'll start with you. It's, you know, I ran into a CEO and founder of a major retail group, and he said that He was just very sad, and I saw him in Tokyo in one of his stores, and he said, you know, we lost 15 factories and producers, you know, in and around the Sendai region. And I think it's going to be interesting because we've been focused on the supply chain for, you know, whether it's for Nissan or whether it's for Toshiba. And you know, within all of that, I think when we think of supply chain, we think of also factories of 1,000 people. Mm. But what hasn't come out yet are, you know, these very important small to medium-sized enterprises, which are just 40 people, 50 people. And this gentleman was saying, you know, this was just a, you know, he said, I can't believe it. He goes, one of our most important suppliers is like a suit factory of 10 people. And Andrew, it's almost like sort of, you know, like, you know, a large part of the German Mittelstand was lost.
Yeah, it's going to be extraordinary to see what happens when there's this kind of whole tier of companies and businesses that have been lost. And also, you know, just the way the infrastructure works, you have, you know, whole fishing fleets gone. You have whole suppliers of food, of all sorts of small companies that were based up the coast, just vanished. And I think also the odd thing, which we haven't seen yet, which will also wake up people around the world, is, you know, that we have a lot of factories here that are Japanese-owned and run factories, which are dependent on parts coming from Japan. And it will be interesting to see how many of those have to go to kind of shorter working weeks, or whether they can keep their production up when they're dependent on these parts often coming from smaller factories coming to the UK, coming to Europe, whether that's because the factories have been hit by the tsunami or more likely that they're hit by power cuts. So I think it's going to have quite a ripple around the global economy as well.
Mm, and that's on the industrial side. But I was just saying to Tyler, I stepped out last night to a traditional Japanese sort of izakaya bistro and was sharing a bottle of sake with a friend, and he looked at it and said, "My God, this sake is from Miyagi." Miyagi Prefecture was probably the worst hit, and it was a lovely sake with a beautiful label, and it was one of the brewers that was completely washed away. And that illustrates, I mean, that was one that had generations that were running this brewer, and it's all gone. So I think there's probably a lot of examples like that. And also in Miyagi nearby was Kesenuma, the fishing port that was completely, I mean, I think everyone's seen footage by now of it being wiped away. That was the main landing spot for a lot of the tuna, bonito, Pacific soury fish, and one wonders, I mean, that's going to have huge effects, I'm sure, on you know, the entire sushi industry, God knows what else. So there are those things to think about as well.
Fiona, you've spent so much time over the last 4 years, you know, covering small furniture manufacturers, textile makers, and I think that's one of the things which has, you know, slightly been lost, but also understandably, at least, you know, where we are in terms of coverage at the moment. But there are so many small specialist manufacturers, you know, particularly who feed into a global design community up there as well.
I think it's something that people maybe don't realize about Japan. It's so famous for these enormous companies like Toyota and very high-tech companies like Nintendo. But actually, when you spend a lot of time in Japan, you realize there's this amazing bedrock of small family-run companies, you know, as Gwen said, they've been going for generations. And I think it's going to take a while before people realize what's been lost. Now, obviously, Tohoku is a quiet region, but it is famous for certain things and certain crafts. And it's just going to be awful and fascinating as well to see what survives, actually, from that. Because we've seen the footage, you know, in some places, nothing will have survived. So we're just going to have to wait and see, I think.
We're going to come back to our conversation in a moment. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're in Tokyo. We're back after this. You're back with Monocle Weekly in Tokyo. Gwen, just before we wrap up, and I just want to also go to Fiona and Andrew. Very hard to lay out a roadmap, but I think everyone has spent enough time certainly in this country and enough time covering it. But, you know, how does it go for the next, you know, the coming weeks and certainly, you know, what this looks like then, you know, for the next 36 months?
Right. Well, first, I don't think we're even out of the crisis stage because there's still unresolved, you know, the nuclear plant situation and so on. And there's probably still more awful discoveries to come in terms of, you know, death toll and destruction. However, I think it's already clear, and I have to agree, I've seen some very good analyst notes and commentaries pointing out that in some ways there is, sounds cliche, but there is a silver lining here, which is that for once, you know, like Japan's ridiculous politics, which have for the last few years just become more and more infantile with the opposition blocking the government and for all the wrong reasons, nothing to do with national interest, stuffing around governments falling, governments rising, trying to implement sort of special budgets to stimulate the economy. Nothing has worked. That's because, you know, Japan has been at odds with itself. And despite the orderliness and the care and the courtesy we're seeing now, on the political level and also on some commercial levels, it's really very counterproductive, some of the, you know, intra-factional fighting. And I think all that is gone. I mean, there's a real sense in Japan between all those groups of, you know, in politics, business, the public, of pulling together. And so I think in some ways, Mr. Khan, if he remains prime minister, and it looks like this may have saved him, even though he was looking very dodgy before the quake, has been handed an extremely big chance. He could really help rebuild. Out of this could come something new, something positive. And as you say, you know, a whole rethinking of how do they reconstruct. This is, in some ways, a very good opportunity. And I spoke to one analyst who was saying, in fact, you know, the fundamental thing first is going to be a complete rethinking of not just energy policy and what sort of plants they build next, but coastal defence, port facilities, breakwaters for tsunami. These are all huge projects. But I think on every level, this is a moment for Japan, and they could grab it and run with it and turn it into something, you know, positive.
I mean, Fiona, the mood here at the moment is, you know, is very strange, and it is so down at the moment. And, you know, there's, I think, as enthusiastic as we always are about Japan, I sort of feel that you know, will they be able to pull themselves up, and, you know, and will it just be business as usual, or is it going to be worse? Or do you agree with Gwen that maybe, you know, this is, goodness sake, no one wanted this type of catastrophe, but the reaction to this might be a positive one?
Gwen made lots of really interesting points there. I mean, Japan has lost a lot of confidence recently. You certainly get the impression, talking to people, you know, they're aware that they've ceded their second place economy to China, and they're aware of the rise of the Korean economy. And I think recently it's feeling insecure. And I think in some ways, really, people are obviously pulling together. It does sound very corny, but you definitely get that sense that they're showing their best colours in this, in a really terrible time, and something positive could come out of this. And I think absolutely, you know, in chiming in with what Gwen said, I think people were really sick of these very divisional, very pointless political disputes and endless revolving prime ministers. Maybe that's something positive that will come out of it. I certainly hope so.
Andrew?
Oh, yeah, you can imagine that, you know, for some of the big corporations in Japan, that the idea of kind of rebuilding whole cities and rebuilding ports, you know, that's going to, unfortunately, be good for their bottom line eventually. But I guess the other thing is just that psychological thing that needs to be negotiated as well, because I heard some of the reports saying that in the past people had been cautious. They'd tried to build their houses, you know, 1 kilometre or 2 kilometres from the sea, fearing that there could one day be a tidal wave. And now they realise that 6 kilometres was actually the distance you needed to be safe. So I think that there's going to be a huge amount of just mental rethinking about how you live along that coastline and where you build and what you build, that will probably take a little bit of time to kind of for people to come to terms with, because, of course, there's a natural instinct for people who have survived to go back to the spot that they lived and to reclaim their place. But as we've seen, many of those towns are just have vanished. So it's going to be, I think, some time before people know what to do.
Gwen, just from, I guess, the leadership side, and as you said, you know, maybe this is just what saved Prime Minister Khan. Do you think that there will also perhaps be, you know, a new culture in government as well, where people are going to stick around for the fight rather than, let's say, doing the Japanese thing as well? I have to bow out. Someone making, you know, sometimes a horrendous mistake, sometimes not the biggest mistake. Mm-hmm. And, you know, instead of just saying sorry, but I'm going to do better next time, as opposed to heading for the door. And I'm wondering if there'd be a certain level of fight that we'll see now, that, you know, if we're really going to stay in the game, you know, one has to do that.
Well, I'd be interested in what you actually think about that question.
Yeah, well, I think that I would hope, but beyond that, I sometimes think that there is this growing frustration, and I think some of the things I heard over the last few days, you know, I think aside from, you know, I think one of the most interesting things was talking to a hotel manager and said that Japanese regional managers, you know, were flown in or sent in by train, but a lot of, you know, Japanese managers who, you know, were based in Singapore and Hong Kong had to come in and fill the shoes of, let's say, their European or American or Canadian or Aussie counterparts who are already at the airport. And it was interesting that to hear it from a Western hotel manager saying really she felt for the first time that this was, you know, that the Japanese were being quite vocal about that, and that the rebuilding was going to have to be done, certainly not on their own, but they were sort of left holding the bag a little bit.
Well, that's interesting. I think it's still too early to see whether this terrible, we're feeling it even sitting here with you in Tokyo, we can feel it, and it's a very strong feeling, obviously, in the north. But I don't even know if the whole country, I don't know what people in Hokkaido and Okinawa, whether they feel we're all in this together. I think there'll be, it'll take time. I covered the Kobe earthquake in 1995, actually, just to date myself. And, you know, there was a similar trauma in the aftermath and sort of all these vows to rebuild Kobe from the ashes. And actually, you know, it went quite well. But like everything, and as we've seen with, you know, Barack Obama in America, and how there was so much spirit and hope and support for him when he first came in, and how that sort of dissipated, these kind of good intentions can dissipate. I think in Japan, you know, there can be a lot more sort of consistency, and hopefully they may just sort of, you know, stick to all the expressions of commitment and determination that we're hearing now.
We'll be revisiting the story definitely over the weeks, months, and I'm sure years to come. Gwen Robinson, Fiona Wilson in Kyoto, and Andrew Tuck in London. Thanks very much for joining me. That's all for this week's edition of the Monocle Weekly from Tokyo. Our sound engineers were Yasuki Shimizu here at TBS and Chris Sharp in London. And our show is produced by Alexander Mills with special support from our colleague Atsushi Okahashi. We're launching a special appeal for Japan in the form of a leather wristband made by a local producer using materials from the Miyagi region. And you can find out more by visiting the shopping pages of monocle.com about how to support our project. We're back in Europe next week, but for now, for all of us in Tokyo, I'm Tyler Berlay. Goodbye.